So who were the owners of most of this $1.5 trillion that we moved outside the country? You can easily guess that a large part of this is controlled by corporations directly linked to the Russian state.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Western countries have seized hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian assets following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago. Since then, the question of what to do with those assets has loomed large over debates about Ukraine. Many people, including my guest today, believe that these funds should be confiscated and used to support Ukraine's reconstruction. Vladimir Milov is a former deputy minister of energy of the Russian Federation and now a Russian opposition politician. He recently wrote a piece for the GlobeSec think tank articulating the necessity of using seized Russian assets for Ukraine's reconstruction. We kick off our conversation discussing the nature of these seized assets, how much we're talking about, where these assets are frozen, and why there is much more Russian money hidden outside of Russia than has been frozen thus far. We then discuss the growing momentum around plans to expropriate that money and use it for rebuilding Ukrainian infrastructure destroyed by Russia. I'll post a link to the article upon which this conversation is based in the show notes of this episode, and it originally appeared on the website of the think tank GlobeSec, which focuses on Central and Eastern Europe and is really a think tank and organization that should be on your radar. I've followed their work for a long time, and they consistently put out content that I think would be particularly interesting and relevant to my Global Dispatches audience. Now, here is my conversation with Vladimir Milov, Russian opposition politician. So just to kick off, how much are we talking about in terms of seized Russian assets at this point?
There are various estimates. I think there's this widespread estimate of $300 billion, but what I'm specifically talking about is that we need to properly locate, because these are just general estimates. And some of the assets that have been mentioned, like at least part of the Russia Central Bank reserves, they are not properly located. This figure, part of it is taken from some analytical reports or something, and there is a debate. I mean, there are some people who are saying that only just over $100 billion are really properly located and properly frozen. So there's a varying estimate. And one of the points that I'm making is that there are so much more Russian assets out there up for seizure and confiscation. So some search should be undergone to beef this number up. Because obviously neither $100 billion nor $300 billion would not be nearly enough to finance the needs for reconstruction of Ukraine.
Like, do you have any kind of back of the envelope estimates if there is a robust search effort underway for hidden Russian assets, how much might be uncovered and potentially repurposed for Ukrainian reconstruction?
To my best knowledge, it takes place on a limited scale because, you know, international governments, they clearly distinguish between state-owned assets, which is a clear-cut case up for seizure and potential confiscation because Russian state is obviously internationally responsible for paying damage caused by Russia's aggression against Ukraine. But there is also a lot of parastatal entities, which and here is where Russian opposition can offer a lot of help. We can properly connect some of the assets which are not visible on surface. They are connected to the Russian state, but as a matter of fact, they are. So this is what we're talking about, and it will take some legal expertise and will take some establishing some links with the Russian government, but it is possible to do. So a lot of these hidden, dressed-up assets are out there, and to my best knowledge, the worldwide search is not underway currently, but it's necessary to do it.
And the parastatal assets, essentially you're talking about like oligarchs who have benefited from close relationships to the state to amass vast amounts of wealth, and their money is not necessarily privately held wealth if you peel the surface back a little bit.
That plus, importantly, you know, Russian economy is run on dominating state-controlled corporations, which is, I think it's not very hard to legally prove that they are an integral part of the Russian government, effectively Russian government arms, which are operating worldwide. To begin with, they were established with state's decisions and investments by the state capital and so on. So they are effectively not different from the Russian government, but they are operating separately in name only. So there is a lot of detail and nuance, but what we're arguing for is that we need to look at things broader than just the assets formally owned by the Russian government, because usually the structure of ownership of state and parastatal entities is like a matryoshka kind of thing, you know, where you have a box within the box within the box. But to provide a solid legal link to the Russian government, it's not that hard. It takes certain effort, but it's not that hard. This is what we're talking about.
So can you just take a step back and remind listeners how these assets that currently are frozen and are located, how did they become frozen? What were the circumstances?
Simply because of Russia's unprovoked aggression against Ukraine 2 years ago, and there was a lot of international sanctions introduced. One of those are freezing of the assets that were available at the time in Western financial institutions. And this was the only proper reaction to Russian aggression because Russia wanted to continue uninterrupted financial operations with these assets on the background of attempts to basically destroy the nation of Ukraine. And the Western governments reacted properly and frozen those. Now I think we are discussing further steps, meaning confiscation of these assets for the purpose of their transfer to Ukraine to finance Ukraine's reconstruction needs.
I mean, is it fair to say that Russia in the, you know, years leading up to the invasion or the full-scale invasion of Ukraine was really limiting its outbound capital flows? And so the amounts we're talking about may not be particularly huge or not as big as they might have been.
To some extent, and here we come back to the previous discussion, yes, Russia did limited exposure, international exposure of federal agencies and assets directly owned by the government. It also has some unpleasant experiences before, because some of the actors who face difficulties in Russia and the illegal seizure of their assets and appeal to international courts, like the Yukos oil company in the past 15 years, they actually have been managed to get the decisions of international courts to seize and confiscate Russian assets to repay damages to these companies and to Yukos in particular, which is why not only in connection with the preparation for the war, but because of that risk of seizure of assets due to actions of some private players, Russia was wary and was sort of shielding their assets abroad from all these potential measures. But they nonetheless have been moving a lot of capital indirectly controlled by the state to other jurisdictions. They wanted to shield themselves by saying that, oh, it's not really government's assets. It's just some corporation, which is not really private, which is owned by the Russian state. Some oligarchic money moved to offshore. So they wanted to still keep the money abroad, but shield them through formalities, through denying that this money formally has anything to do with the Russian government.
And you're saying, just to reiterate a point you've already made, that amount of money probably is vastly larger than the amount of currently frozen official Russian assets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There were different estimates, but I mean, just like, you know, the official estimate of capital outflow from Russia in the past 15 years by the Russian Central Bank. That is a net result of the movements on capital accounts. How much capital were moved out of Russia is over $1.5 trillion in the past 15 years. Over $1.5 trillion. So some people legally, government allowed this, moved certain capital out of Russia. If you look at the structure of the Russian economy, it is vastly dominated by state-controlled players. So who were the owners of most of this $1.5 trillion that were moved outside the country? You can easily guess that a large part of this is controlled by corporations directly linked to the Russian state.
So of the assets that have been frozen by the West, where are most of these assets being held right now? Like, where are they scattered around the world?
Mostly in Europe. I think the biggest part is probably in UK. Other is parts in certain jurisdictions in the European Union, significant part in Switzerland, as far as I understand. The United States has only a limited part of it, so I would say we're mostly talking about Europe, particularly with significant emphasis on the United Kingdom.
What about Belgium? I've heard that Belgium, just because of its location as the exchange point between the euro and international financial exchanges, just happens to have a lot of Russian assets at the moment.
That's true. And this is a notable part. Euroclear frozen assets are a notable part of this whole stock of Russian assets that were frozen due to aggression against Ukraine. But again, I would say that Belgium is lagging far behind Britain in terms of the amount of assets. Britain has been sort of boasting about being the champion of frozen Russian assets, which is probably true.
So you make a very compelling argument for how and why these frozen assets ought to be repurposed for Ukraine's reconstruction. I do want to talk through, however, some of the political risks associated with your position, which you acknowledge in your piece. Nonetheless, you argue that the benefits outweigh the risks. Before we do get into the political risks, though, there are essentially two very compelling arguments legally, why this is justified and why this is not justified and illegal. You know, in general, you can't seize a foreign country's assets, but also in general, I've seen legal arguments saying that countries that invade another country illegally in the way that Russian has is obliged to pay reparations. So you can have like lawyers kind of debate this point on and on end, which I don't think we want to get into. But is that like a fair summation of the legal arguments here?
I think the main key argument is about the property rights. And this is actually what is promoted by the Kremlin's propaganda, that property rights in the Western system should be sacred, and that's the violation of property rights and illegal seizure and so on. I think we should be very clear here, because the primary issue is not the issue of a Russian property in question. The primary issue is the issue of destroyed Ukrainian property. Russia illegally attacked Ukraine and essentially destroyed really a lot of assets in Ukrainian economy, worth hundreds of billions of dollars. We can go into precise estimates, but as a matter of fact, we're talking about hundreds of billions. So somebody has to pay for it. And there is a United Nations General Assembly Resolution 11.5, which is extremely clear. It was adopted by a majority of United Nations member states, which is extremely clear. And it says, as per United Nations Charter, the aggressor party, which is in this case Russia, should compensate all these damages. So it is like if you take a loan from a bank and go spend it all and lose this money in a casino, and bank comes to seize your property, like your apartment. And you say, no, this is my apartment and I have a certificate. You can't do anything about my property rights. But the bank correctly says, you owe me. You have taken my property and spent it, so I have a right to reclaim it back. That is the mechanism, which I think the primary issue here is the issue of destroyed Ukrainian property. It was certified by United Nations General Assembly resolution, so Russia has to pay somehow. And I think the only missing link here, which is also, it's not exactly a legal question, but an important procedural question. I think there should be a formal request, probably by G7 member states, a formal request to Russia. I don't know if anybody had ever made this kind of request, whether Russia is intending to comply with this November 2022 United Nations Resolution 11.5, or whether it does not, and set a certain deadline, like 30 days, 90 days, whatever, right? If Russia fails to answer or answers negatively, I think this will really add up legal significance to actions aimed at confiscating their property. Because without it, this question is kind of hanging in the air. It is not legally connected. This Russian property is not legally connected to destroyed Ukrainian property and United Nations resolution. We need to establish a legal connection. So some kind of that step is necessary.
What has prevented the Western countries from doing this so far? I mean, we're 2 years into this conflict, and this seems like just a very straightforward and like morally compelling, if not obvious, solution to help pay for part of Ukraine's reconstruction. What political risks thus far have prevented Western policymakers from taking this action up to this point?
I think they were like 99% of the time probably consumed by internal conversations with their own lawyers, bureaucrats, legal teams. You know, I used to be a bureaucrat myself. I worked for 6 years in the Russian government, and government lawyers, oh boy, I mean, nothing is possible ever with them. When you come down with stuff to them, they say, no, you can't do this because it's against the law. So anything, basically, when you approach them with certain political decisions, the lawyers are always very defensive because they don't want to go into courts. They don't want to add some extra job. So they're usually very defensive and they say, no, 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 never. We will be sued and so on. I'm actually making the argument that, listen, the chance that Western governments will be sued in third countries with successful outcome because of the Russian assets are very low, and you can still defend yourself in court because you still have a solid legal base like UN resolution and so on. But lawyers usually are very protective of themselves. They don't want to engage in an uncertain fight. So they spend a lot of time arguing with their own lawyers and legal teams. I think right now they're moving towards a political solution. And I think it would really be helpful if there was an international inquiry, official inquiry to Russia, whether it intends to comply with the UN resolution on paying damage to Ukraine.
So you're saying basically the reason this hasn't happened yet was just like internal bureaucratic dynamics. But I'm wondering if there is like a broader political risk. Like, do governments in the West think that if they take this kind of unprecedented action to seize a foreign government's assets and repurpose them in such a way that they might make, you know, their own economies more exposed, more vulnerable, like other countries might not want to park their money there? Like, is that registering at all?
You know, the issue is that if you look at some international statistics, like accumulated total foreign direct investment stock by the country, which is clearly dominated by a democratic Western world, this is where people want to keep and store their assets, not somewhere in the global South dictatorships without any rule of law, right? If you look at the structure of the currencies stored in the financial reserves of the central banks worldwide, that's 90% countries representing Western democracy, US dollar, euro, Japanese yen, Swiss franc, Canadian, Australian dollars. This is what we see. It's funny. Russia is now trying to use all these other non-Western currencies in their transactions because of the international sanctions. They try to use all these renminbi, Indian rupee, whatever dirham, whatever currencies in their transactions. It doesn't work that well because these are overly regulated, low liquidity, very volatile currencies. So there is no alternative to Western system as a place to invest money. There is no alternative to Western currencies because the global South, as we know it, has essentially failed to create an attractive system where property is protected, which has liquidity and free-flowing currencies that are in demand by the market. So there is no such thing as, you know, if European Union seizes some Russian assets, reserves would go elsewhere. Where? Into Indian rupee. Russians don't want to use Indian rupee. because it's overregulated and cannot be used properly outside India. So I think the West should really truly estimate its significant market power here, which is a result and a product of a solid Western institutions, guarantees of property rights, transparency, and lack of arbitrariness and favoritism. This is where investors go, and they won't stop because there is no other place. And this is where liquid and demanded currencies are emitted, because in other places of the world, it's murky, it's heavily regulated, non-transparent, and so on.
I mean, basically what I'm hearing from you is that progress towards the idea that you can repurpose confiscated or frozen Russian assets towards Ukrainian reconstruction, it's all a matter of political will. So where do you see the political will today? Do you see momentum building towards this idea in key forums like the G7 and in capitals around the world, like in the United States, which, even though it doesn't, you know, hold a tremendous amount of Russian assets, nonetheless is a key leader in the financial markets?
Yes, I think the political will is clearly moving in the right direction, in the direction of confiscating Russian assets, at least partially. So Europe is now talking about confiscating only profits and earnings from the Russian assets that are frozen, not the body of assets themselves. But anyway, that's a good move in the right direction, at least the beginning of a process, which, if it happens, we will at least be able to see whether these risks that we're talking about actually materialize, or it was all hypothetical. I would bet that it was all hypothetical, but remains to be seen. I mean, let's give it a fair shot. So I see the political will clearly moving into the right direction for two reasons. First, because all the legal debates already happened. So the arguments have been laid out, pro and against. So that usually comes down to politicians making the actual decision. The second thing is that the need for financing Ukraine's reconstruction becoming so pressing that we need to get the money from somewhere.
It's like we're not getting it from the U.S. Congress right now, that's for sure.
Yes, but with the U.S. Congress and with the EU macro-financial assistance and military aid by Europeans, we're talking about only financing some current stuff, current budget needs, current supplies of weapons. But what we're talking here is a large part of Ukraine is destroyed by Russia. Significant part of infrastructure and industry is destroyed. It needs to be rebuilt. There's no money for that. Because of the lack of sufficient Western financial aid, Ukraine has adopted a nationwide budget for this year when they cut off nearly all capital expenditure. This is insane. So they have to sacrifice capital expenditure because they can't find money to finance the dire current needs and so on. That's not good. The issue of reconstruction and rebuilding and capital spending would become, is already becoming very, very pressing, but would become even more so in the coming months and years. So a solution needs to be found, and it's better to do it rather sooner than later.
So let me ask you, say your idea is put into process and indeed assets are seized and put towards Ukrainian reconstruction. I know this is like all very complicated, but broadly speaking, like how might that work? Like, does a new entity need to be created to manage this money? What would be some elements of what this would look like in action?
There are plenty of options. One of the options is you can create some, I don't know, Luxembourg-based funds controlled by Western donors, which will actually allocate specific money for the reconstruction purposes. What is important is that Ukrainians might submit some applications for specific needs, specific projects, and so on. And the West might store this money, okay, even in European jurisdiction, and make a decision to disburse and allocate some of the funds basing on approval of some Ukrainian projects. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it would be to transfer this money directly to Ukrainians. I would say that, you know, because there's a lot of talk in the West about Ukrainian corruption, Ukraine, as a matter of fact, had made a lot of progress in the recent years in terms of fighting corruption. It was lagging far behind Russia in the Transparency International ranking like 10 years ago. Right now, it is significantly better. Not yet in the first 100 of least corrupt countries, but it's close. Still, if there is some doubt or lack of trust, this can be done under control of some European established entity. There are plenty of options how to do that, but I think these are all technicalities, and we just need to proceed with a political decision.
On that point, in the coming months or weeks, are there any key moments where a political decision might be made that would suggest to you whether or not we are progressing on this idea? Are there any meetings or upcoming events or anything you're looking towards that will suggest to you whether or not this idea is moving ahead?
I suggest that most likely it will happen at the G7 meeting in June. So G7 traditionally took the lead in this issue, and there's also a need of a broad consultation and unity between different and also non-European democratic countries, including Canada, Japan. So this is why I think G7 is probably the time and the place where most do expect it. And I see that the European Union is also looking towards that because they also have European elections coming, and they are right now pretty busy with all these charming domestic issues like farmers' protests and all that stuff. So I would elections in the EU are early June, so I would really expect that this issue, we have to wait like about three more months to see the ice melting and G7 finally taking the lead in confiscation of these assets.
Before we go, is there any like point you wanted to make or a question I didn't ask, anything you wanted to get in?
You know, because I'm a Russian, I'm being frequently asked this, but how can you support this if you represent Russia? Now, listen, I represent the modern future democratic Russia, which does not deny responsibility. Absolutely. I mean, me and my colleagues throughout our life, we always loved and were deeply affectionate for the beautiful nation of Ukraine. And we're absolutely devastated by the barbarity that Putin is doing. And yes, we have to pay. So because of our knowledge about how Russian system works and where the Russian assets are, we feel like it is our duty to contribute to these efforts of the free world to help Ukraine reconstruct itself, even more so because the aggression comes from my own country. And I feel responsibility, and many of my colleagues in the Russian opposition do so. So we'll be committed to assist this process in the best way we can.
And it seems like to that point, I mean, the assets you're talking about seizing and hunting down, those of like oligarchs, I mean, it seems taking that money is a better way to prevent the immiseration of ordinary Russian people if being forced to pay reparations, you know, decades, generations into the future.
Absolutely. And we all remember the post-Versailles situation when Germany was overburdened with reparations after World War I, and that contributed to the rise of the revanchist sentiment in the Nazi party. We all need to remember that experience. And don't forget, Russia was robbed in the previous years, brutally, viciously robbed by Putin's cronies. So it's not ordinary Russians who have to pay. And there are ways to find the money to finance the reconstruction of Ukraine without actually getting into the pockets of Russians. So one of the reasons I'm advocating for this is to shield ordinary Russian people from all these negative consequences, but as a matter of fact, to take the money out of pockets of those who started all this, Putin and his oligarchy, which started this aggression against Ukraine.
Vladimir, thank you so much for your time. Stay safe, and I hope to keep up on this issue with you in the near future.
Thank you. It was great being with you.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.